So last class, we ended by discussing, at your request, measurement as transformation, our sequential measurements. And so here are some of the themes we're going to just revisit and look at more carefully. One is we want to think about measurement as a kind of transformation. We can also think of measurement as a way to prepare the state. We logically separated state preparation and measurement at the beginning of the class, but now we're going to think about them as actually two aspects of the same thing. And we'll discuss a little more the significance of collapse. So here the idea operationally is that we have go, and we have a knob, and it spits out a system. And then we, so this was state preparation. Which we decided was some row, which is a element of the density operators in some Hilbert space. And then we had the idea of measurement, which had both a knob to determine the type of measurement you were performing. It had a light to announce the fact that some result was obtained. This is a little bit redundant. And we have a pointer. This is choice of measurement. And pointer to the outcome. And now we're going to think about measurement as a transformation. So we're going to allow the possibility of doing further tests on the state that comes out of this box with all of this information available to you. Okay, we can just, you know, repeat. Okay, so last class I told you about von Neumann-Luder's rule. Which is that if we have a measurement, an ideal measurement of some observable A, some projectors pi m. And by ideal here, I also mean that we're going to do it specifically via the indirect measurement method, so we're guaranteed that this rule applies. Guarantees that given some outcome k, the input state rho goes to an output state rho k. So here the state here is rho, and the state here is rho k. Here we had outcome k. And then we have rho k is equal to the projector of rho. And then we renormalized. So So this piece here guarantees renormalization. Guarantees that we have a density operator. So the point is, this is given outcome of, so we call this, so the important thing is that this is the, here rho k is the post-selected state. That is, it's conditioned on an outcome, conditioned on outcome k. In a single shot, e.g. in a single run. In contrast, if I'm going to describe, in contrast, if I'm going to either ignore the outcome k, and this is a recap from last class, if I'm going to ignore the outcome k, or if I'm going to describe the ensemble of all systems that come out of this device, independent of what outcome I got, like maybe I can keep track of the outcomes, but I'm going to throw them all in the same bin afterwards. So I press the go button, a system comes out, press the go button again, another system comes out, and I just want to describe that full ensemble. If I ignore K, if I ignore the outcome, or don't have access to the outcome, or if I just want to describe the ensemble of outputs, the ensemble of output systems, independent of K, independent of the outcome, then the state out, then rho out, is equal to a, and I got this, I had a typo last class that you guys picked up. What we're going to do is we're going to sum over k. We're going to sum over all the outcomes weighted by the probability of that outcome times the output state, which is just equal to sum over k pi k rho pi k. I think I got it right this time. So which case we have depends on whether we're post-selecting on the outcome. Give me some remarks. First remark, the non-post-selected case is consistent with unitary evolution. That's Schrodinger's equation. And we will see, I will show you this. Later, when we discuss transformations. And curiously, the post-selected case which is called state update has a lot of names. It's called state update. It's called the projection postulate. It's called the collapse of the wave function. Is not consistent with Schrödinger evolution. So there's been a lot of debate about this fact, controversy even, as far back as Schrödinger and von Neumann and Einstein. And nowadays, lots of people propose to make the projection postulate consistent with the dynamical evolution. People propose alterations of quantum theory, obscure gravitational interaction effects, many worlds interpretation. There's all kinds of ways around this when you assume this is a problem. And of course, it's not actually a problem. It's perfectly consistent with state update is perfectly consistent with is natural if we think about quantum states as descriptions of our knowledge. Like a classical probability distribution. Descriptions of our knowledge. Rather than physical objects. There is no scientific fact which forces us to think of quantum states as physical objects, but it's widely assumed. And this is essentially a religious commitment. Which it leads to all kinds of contradictions. Basically here, the idea, as I mentioned last class briefly at the end of class, it's analogous to Bayes' rule. There are some differences because quantum mechanics is different than classical probability theory. But typically the way that the paradox is posed is by saying that, look, unitary evolution is continuous. It's deterministic. The vector is determined by the unitary. Continuous, deterministic, and what's the third thing people say? Well, there's a third property. Continuous, deterministic, and linear. It's linear evolution. Whereas the state update rule is discontinuous, non-deterministic, and not linear. Just a moment, please. The same thing happens if you look at Liouville mechanics, which we'll see later, which describes how your information evolves classically about some cannonball or, you know, whatever. Your physical system is a ball rolling around on some hillside. If you have incomplete knowledge about the position or momentum of the ball and you describe that with a density function, a probability density, that probability density evolves continuously, deterministically, and linearly in classical Euler mechanics. But when you make an observation and gain new information about that system, you have to change the Liouville density, you have to change the state, and you change it in a way that's discontinuous, nonlinear, and indeterministic, because you don't know what outcome you're going to get. So based on the outcome you get, that's what determines. So it's not determined until you specify the outcome. So it's completely analogous to the quantum setting. I probably won't spend as much time harping on this as I did previous years, but are there any questions?
Yeah, when you also the non-post-selected case, are you talking about the, is that the one where we throw away the information we've got?
Mm-hmm. The non-post-selected case is just essentially decoherence from interacting with an external system. When we derive the Krauss operators, we'll see an example of that. Cool. So I'll give you an explicit example of this.
So you can put down a unitary transformation which takes like, which takes away, like, you know, starts from a water function and gives you a decoherence.
Yeah, so the unitary will be on a bigger Hilbert space. It's a unitary that acts on the system of interest and another system, and that way you can take a pure state on your system to a mixed state on your system because you've lost purity to the external, the ancilla system. I think we've already seen hints of that. You had a question in the back. Is that withdrawn or? Yeah.
I'm just wondering about the hat convention here. Is there?
It's when I remember them.
Okay.
So if it's a linear operator, there should be a hat on it.
Okay.
So I assume you guys are advanced enough at this stage that you can tell from context. If you can't, just ask.
Just drop the hats.
Well, if I can drop them, I can drop them. All right.
No hats.
Just do that. Another question?
So do you have to consider a measurement as a unitary operation of our state?
A measurement as a unitary operation. Well, we've seen the formalism for measurements, and there's no unitaries involved. Well, there's a unitary if you unpack it as this von Neumann indirect measurement method, then there's a unitary in that picture. But what do you have in mind?
No, I mean, the contradiction to the collapse, and that we are discussing now. So, if I understand well, the contradiction is to the fact that a unitary operator is continuous and the evolution of a system
yes.
Under a unitary operator is continuous and all of that. And when we do a measurement, we can't say that we apply a unitary operator, right?
Right. Well, so, the change is, yeah, there's no unitary that will correctly describe what happened.
Yeah, I mean, is that a problem?
Well, it's not a problem. So here's why people think it's a problem. Here's the thing. So von Neumann, one of the greatest geniuses of our century, okay, laid out the mathematical formulation of quantum mechanics, hugely influential in a wide variety of areas of mathematics. So he spends like 10 pages in his book from the 30s going on about how this is insane because he was thinking of quantum states as physical objects. And he was like, look, here's what's weird. If I want to describe the evolution of the system, I have to use a unitary operator. But if I want to describe a measurement process, I can't use that. I have to use this other thing, this rule, this what he called von Neumann rule. It was von Neumann's rule at the time, and later it was fixed. But and he said, now think about Schrodinger's equation is a dynamical law. So if you make two assumptions, one is that quantum states are physical, and two, that you know dynamical laws describe how physical states evolve. Then Neumann said, well, whether or not I'm making a measurement changes which dynamical law is affecting my physical system. So he went into this long digression of trying to understand, well, when is it appropriate to use which of these two dynamical physical laws, and how can we have this dichotomy at the core of our theory that there are two different dynamical laws for evolution of the states? But so that's, I mean, the point is you have to go down that path, and there's no happy resolution. I mean, that's why there's all these essentially crazy ideas out there about how to resolve this problem, is because it's not resolvable. The resolution is that it's not a problem in that classically we have the same phenomenon, it's not a problem, because we don't think about the Liouville density or a probability distribution as a physical object. And so the physical system is evolving according to a dynamical law, but our information evolves according to different rules, rules of probability theory like Bayes' rule. And so there's two different levels of description at play, and that's the resolution of this tension. So maybe I'll just add one of my favorite quotes. So this is the famous measurement problem, right?
This is the so-called measurement problem. And Hideo Mabuchi from Caltech has the best definition of the measurement problem I've ever heard. His quote is this: the measurement problem is a set of people. Yes?
Yes, so the set of people seems to be quite large.
Yes, the majority. So I'm in the minority, by the way. Yeah. So just you have to either trust me or think I'm crazy, one of the two.
Can you comment on maybe briefly why people disagree with you? Because it seems reasonable.
I think, look, some people are Muslim, some people are Christian. I can't change their views, right? It's a personal belief.
But you can't argue with people about this. So maybe just for the sake of, like, I mean, the students might understand what the other arguments.
Okay, well, the other arguments, I think the other arguments start from a core emotional assumption that quantum mechanics is a fundamental theory. The fundamental object in the theory is the wave function. Because it's a physical theory, the fundamental mathematical object of the theory must be a physical object. I think that's what's at play. You can't argue with that. I mean, it's just people make that emotional commitment, and then okay, so I am over 40, by the way. But most physicists over 40 can't even stop the habit of thinking of quantum states as physical to even understand what you're saying when you make this point. So it's just enormously frustrating. But anyways, I don't want to monopolize your time with this discussion, but I think it's important that you understand the conceptual distinctions at play while you're learning quantum mechanics so that you have an open mind if this issue arises later. Yeah?
I was just going to say, what is their descriptions of our knowledge of what? That's the question.
Well, okay, the safest answer, that's a great question, by the way, and the safest answer to that is our knowledge about the possible outcomes of future tests of the system. It's a very operational kind of, let's not make any commitments about physical objects. But I happen to believe that there's even a deeper answer, although it's an unfinished research program, which is in terms of understanding that there are physical properties underlying quantum states, and it's knowledge about those properties, but how to actually construct a theory that's satisfactory, and yes, I'm talking about hidden variables here, how to construct a satisfactory theory of hidden variables where the quantum states are incomplete knowledge about those physical variables, that's an open research program. And so I'll tell you some, you know, like Rob Speckens is a researcher here, is one of the champions of this view, dates back, actually it was actually Einstein's point. Einstein and Schrodinger. So you've all heard about Schrodinger's cat. And Schrodinger's cat, you know, you see Schrodinger quoted as saying, you know, the problem with, you know, we put a cat in a box and we put a radioactive sample in there, and the radioactive sample has a 50-50 chance of decaying. But of course, under unitary evolution, there's a superposition of it decaying and not decaying. We arrange so that the decay event triggers a Geiger counter, which leads to a mechanical device which smashes a vial of cyanide and kills the cat. If the decay event has not occurred, the cat is still happily alive in the box. Now, by unitary evolution, the superposition of the atomic decay event translates to or directly implies deterministically and linearly a superposition of the cat being alive and dead. So now Schrodinger is quoted as saying that, and lots of research say, oh, so Schrodinger obviously thought that cats were in a superposition of being alive and dead. But what the poor guy, if you go and look up the paper where he writes this, the sentence prior to the paragraph in which he's quoted says, if you assume the quantum states are physical, you're led to absurd conclusions, for example. So he was making fun of the view, not endorsing the view, even though it's widely thought that he was endorsing that view. Yeah.
I was going to say something along the lines of what Dan said, but like earlier you said, you know, the physical system is evolving according to some law, and this is just our information about that. But I mean, it really was. I was just going to repeat what you said pretty much.
Oh, okay, so that was the
yeah, like what it. It's just that we don't know what that physical law is. Mm-hmm. If we assume that there are physical objects.
Yeah.
Even if we don't assume that the wave function is one of them.
Yeah, well, it's a compelling issue.
People are emotionally attached to there being physical objects of some kind.
And as I mentioned at the start of the class, and I'll bring it up again now because it's very relevant, in my opinion, the progress on the problem of quantum gravity will actually require a deeper conceptual understanding of what are the physical properties that we're describing incompletely by our quantum mechanics. Those are the things that are gravitating. And until we understand that, I mean, I think it's guesswork. Yes.
So, don't we have an example already of hidden variable?
There are examples.
Yeah, there's a good problem.
The problem is that the problem is underdetermined.
Right.
And so there are lots of different hidden variable theories you can just construct,
right.
And it's not clear, you know, how to pick one over another. It's actually not that easy to build them. So there's a big landscape to explore, and we need good insights and to give us. Kind of some sense of direction in this landscape. And so that's why it's kind of an open problem. And that's why it's been an open problem for, 80 years. And so just repeating again, this was Einstein's point of view. Einstein's often dismissed as not being able to accept the new reality of quantum mechanics. But I think he actually had the deepest understanding of quantum mechanics of his contemporaries. So you don't have to trust me. You can just, trust Einstein. Are there other questions about this?
I might be completely wrong, but when we're talking about state update, we're only talking about it just because we do not know how to make the measurement. I mean, the state, their measurement has been made and the state has collapsed, but we don't know how to interpret that. And we don't know how to accept that.
Well, what do you mean by interpret it? I mean, there's a interpretation in terms of Bayes' rule. I gave that example last class of, you have a box with 9 slots, will be any number of slots, and you drop a ball in one of the slots, and there's a probability distribution describing where the ball is. Now, and that's my knowledge of where the ball is in which slot in the box. Now, I can imagine various transformations one can apply. I can shake the box, and I can lift it, I can move it, and that will have some deterministic impact on how the ball bounces around, which in turn will affect how my probability assignments move around, right? But now if I do something different, if I don't just start translating the box or moving it or rotating it or spinning it, but instead I actually open it up and look in part of the box and check if the particle's there, then I'm gaining knowledge. I'm not just applying some physical transformation. I'm acquiring new information about where the ball is in the box. And then I don't use classical mechanics. I don't use Newton's laws to describe where the change in my probabilities. Now I just use Bayes' rule. And I say, now my probability assignment changes in a discontinuous way based on the information I got from that information. This is, we could have talked about this in 1850. And no one would say, that's weird, that's a paradox. Why are you changing your probability assignments in a discontinuous way? Why do we have to have a different physical principle or physical dynamical law for how the probability distribution changes when I gain information? Well, it's a category mistake. You don't think about that as a physical process. It's a process of acquiring information, therefore it has a different set of rules that describe how it works. And so it's the idea there's two different levels of description, and that's why there's no tension really between them. Yeah.
But last class you mentioned the situation is not entirely the same as the classical case, because even if we get no information, we are changing our description in a non-continuous manner. So it's not just about getting information, right? If we do a measurement but don't look at it,
Speckens, Rob Speckens has built some toy theories which actually have this phenomenon. I'm working on a paper right now, which will be out in a few weeks, where we have a consistent, we take a sub-theory of quantum mechanics and we give a description of it in terms of classical probability theory, and it includes quantum teleportation, entanglement, all of these phenomena that are supposedly quantum just exist in this model. What it also includes this effect of measurement affecting the state, which I said was non-classical, but what we do is we put in a rule, and the rule is that it's impossible to acquire information about the system without disturbing the physical particle. So that means that measurement now has two aspects to it, whereas classically, measurement can be just acquiring information without a physical transformation. If you imagine that every measurement is associated with a physical disturbance, which is very classical, I mean, if I'm baking a souffle and I want to open the oven to see how it's looking, I might collapse it, right? So the idea is just acquiring information can lead to a disturbance. That's actually Luce and Hardy's reference. Yeah. So acquiring information can lead to a disturbance, but classical physics tells us that in principle, there exists some way to gain information without disturbing. But now if we say, well, let's say physics isn't that way, that we can't gain information without disturbing. And there's a good reason for that, which is quantization. So if I think about when Einstein described the photoelectric effect, he said, look, we have to realize that energy is quantized. So the amount of energy associated with some light is an integer multiple of h nu. Okay. So the necessity of disturbance. Okay, so that means that, what does that mean? It means that classically, if I have some light source and I'm using that light to measure some property, what do I want to do? If I want to measure the position of the property with high resolution, then I want the largest frequency I can have because the frequency is inversely proportional to the wavelength. So high frequency is short wavelength, which gives me very good spatial resolution. Classically, I can do that. I can increase the frequency, and I can also tune down the intensity as small as I want it to be. So I can get as precise of a position measurement as I want, and by tuning down the intensity as arbitrarily to an arbitrarily small intensity, I can cause an arbitrarily small disturbance to the momentum, because you're going to get a momentum kick. I'm bouncing light off of the object. I'm capturing that light with a microscope or with a lens. So I'm physically disturbing it. I mean, the point is, how do we acquire information? We use light. We use electrons too, but they're heavy. But the best way to do it is with light. Light bounces off the object, comes into my eye, I acquire information. Classically, I can arrange things so that I impose an arbitrarily small disturbance and I can get an arbitrarily precise position measurement. Quantumly, that's not the case anymore, because the lowest I can have, the lowest amount of energy momentum I can transfer is just with the case when n equals 1. One photon. So now all of a sudden, I can make the wavelength as small as I want, which means really high frequency, but that's going to increase the energy I'm transferring to the object when I observe it. So this simple idea, which we've known since 1905, if we take this as a physical principle of nature, then it implies that you will disturb a system when you measure it. And that's why state update in quantum mechanics doesn't quite fit into Bayes' rule, because there has to be a physical disturbance associated with any information gain. And that's why you would get loss of coherence and things like that. So that's my kind of long-winded answer. We've got all our ducks in a row here. Like, you can keep pushing me on this, and I think I've got answers for everything, but it's just not clear what the right path forward is. All right, so enough of my sales pitch. Let's move on to other material you need to know. So what I wanted to give you an example of... But I do hope to excite you guys about this program, because I mean, we need more bright people working on this problem. Okay, so an example to clarify how state update works. So what we're going to look at is a case where we have two projectors. So we're going to have a first projector, I better stick with my notation here, which will just be some state phi 1, and a second projector, which I'll call P1 perp, and it's a rank 2 projector. Yeah.
In terms of the notation, do you always make that the P projector is the same as the pi projector?
Yeah, I just use P or pi for a variety.
And then M is the measurement operators.
I don't really use M. I use A, or A is the Hermitian observable. Oh, you mean, oh, the measurement operators are M. Yeah, and then E is the POVM element, and the M's are the decomposition of the POVM. Right, so this is a projective measurement, so my measurement then consists of pi 1 and pi 1 perp. And I'm not using any hats anymore. P1 and P1 perp. So that's my measurement. And now let's assume that my initial state, which goes into the measurement device, is some state psi, which is, I'll just call it C1 phi 1 plus C2 phi 2 plus C3 phi 3. So we have a coherent superposition in this basis. Implicitly, I'm assuming that this phi is some basis. I hope that's clear. And I'm doing a measurement which checks, am I in this rank 1 subspace or am I in this rank 2 subspace? So then state update without post-selection. So if I disregard the outcome, then we have rho goes to rho out. And rho out is going to be equal to C1 squared phi 1. Sorry, I'll raise this board up so you can see better. Plus C2 squared phi 2 plus C3 squared phi 3 plus C2 C3 bar phi 2 phi 3 plus C3 C2 bar phi 3 phi 2. Now let me move this up here. And let me ask you the following question. You're probably not completely, maybe you are completely, maybe you're not completely familiar with, that didn't work. Okay, how is the output state different from the input state? Okay, but what terms are missing? Right. Okay, so if you write out the input state, which I gave you as a vector, if we write the outer product, you know, ket psi bra psi, then we would have all cross terms. We'd have phi 1, phi 2 with C1, C2 bar, and phi 2, phi 1 with C1 bar, C2, and phi 1, phi 3. So what we've done here is the measurement process without post-selection has killed off has decohered the state. It's destroyed the coherences between the rank 1 subspace and the rank 2 subspace. That's the key point. So I'll just maybe write that down. Yeah, I've noticed there's some funny. This measurement has removed the coherence terms of the input state rho.
between the subspace P1 and P1 perp, i.e., I should say e.g., terms of the form phi 1, phi 3, etc. But because of the rank 2 nature of the measurement, it's preserved the coherence between the states phi 2 and phi 3. Okay, so this is what came up last class when we were talking about, you can't get any state you want out because if you have a rank 2 measurement, you're going to preserve the relative phase between phi 2 and phi 3. That's the coherence there is the relative phase between phi 2 and phi 3, which is this C2 bar C3. So that's preserved. And of course, if we post select on outcome 1, then row goes to row 1, which is just phi 1, phi 1. The C1 squared term goes away because I've renormalized. So now notice this is a state preparation. Of the pure state phi 1. Okay, so I can think of this measurement as having provided me with the state preparation procedure. And if we post select on the one perp outcome, then we have row, and this is why it's non-deterministic, row 1 perp, which is equal to, let me call it psi psi, where psi is equal to C2 phi 2 plus C3 phi 3.
Divided by the normalization.
Thank you. Divided by the renormalization, which is going to be the square root of C2 squared plus C3 squared. Yes?
Can you explain the remark? The state you got out, you only got the only non, and call it pure projection components are between 2 and 3.
Yeah, I wouldn't say pure, but coherent. Yeah.
So, and here, I'm probably not understanding it right. Here you're saying that there's decoherence between P1 and P2, right? Mm.
Well, between 1 and 2, 1 and 3, and 1 and 3.
But I'm saying those are not the states that have a connection, so the states that you got were mixed. How do you see that, basically?
Sorry, we're looking at two different scenarios. So here's, this is the without post-selection case. So W slash O is without post-selection.
Okay.
So that's a different operational scenario, right?
That's not the scenario we're talking about in the remark?
This is the remark, okay. So what's the question then?
How do you see that you get the coherence, remove the coherence term between one and
how do I see it? What I've done is I've appealed to the, what I've implicitly done here is I've used the rule, right? So the rule is that row without post-selection, I skipped a few steps. I just used the rule, which is that row out is equal to a sum over k, pi k row pi k.
Yeah.
And now,
excuse me.
So my pi k's are now p1 and p1 perp. This is equal to p1 rho p1 plus p1 perp rho p1 perp. Thanks for asking this question, by the way. And now I evaluate these terms. So what's p1? P1 is phi1, phi1. So now I act on the left and the right with this. I've expressed my state. I haven't written out, so I didn't write out the state in full, okay? So, because it's a lot of terms and I was a bit lazy, but you're gonna have all of these outer products, phi1, phi2, phi2, phi1, phi1, phi3. The only term that will survive in the input state is a term that has a, the only term that survives here, only term in rho that survives is the term that looks like this, phi1, phi1. Because that way I have phi1, otherwise I have, if I have phi1 acting on phi2, that goes to zero. And similarly, if I have phi2 acting on phi1 here, I mean phi1 acting on phi2, that goes to zero. So the only term that survives is that. So that means this is equal to c1 squared phi1 phi1. Okay, and now let's consider p1 perp. Which terms are going to survive? Well, p1 perp is equal to phi2 phi2 plus phi3 phi3. So now consider a term in rho of the form c1 c3 phi1 phi3. Now, when I act on this with p1, that goes to 0 because phi3 and phi1 are orthogonal. When I act it on with the p1 perp, the phi3 term can survive, but the phi1 won't survive because it's orthogonal to phi2 and phi3. So this term is going to go to 0. But consider a term of the form c1, c2, c3. Now what happens to this guy? Well, under the P1 projector, it's going to go to 0. But under the P1 perp projector, because remember, it's on both sides here, well, the phi2 term can survive because this guy will let it live. And the phi3 will survive because this term lets it live, right? So we have P1 perp C2 C3 phi2 phi3 P1 perp is just equal to C2, C3, and I can expand it all out, phi2, phi2 plus phi3, phi3 times phi2, phi3, phi2, phi2 plus phi3, phi3. And now, when this acts on this, the point is this lives in this subspace, so it's just 1. And similarly, this lives in this subspace, so it's just 1. And this term survives. So I'm glad you asked that, because I think I should have worked that out in detail, but now we have. So it's hopefully it's clear. Okay, again, I'm getting to neither of the two things I promised you I'd cover today. okay, maybe I'll skip that. I'll skip that too. I'll skip that too. Okay, there are some subtleties with state update under generalized measurement, but maybe I'll just treat that as too advanced for this class. Not too advanced, but just we don't have time to cover all the details here. State update under generalized, would you like me to?
So the homework relies on state update for generalized measurement.
Okay, then let's talk about
it. But maybe it's obvious. No, I know. Yeah, maybe you should just let you. Have you talked about it at all?
No.
Yeah.
No.
It would be good to at least just write it down.
Sure. All right, I'll do it. This one's broken, right? So maybe I'll just... Good. Okay, so the first point I think I mentioned already, but I'll write it down to make sure it's clear. Given some device performing the measurement, the POVM measurement EK, where as usual we have the probability of outcome K is equal to the trace of rho EK. The final state conditioned on outcome K is underdetermined. So you don't know what the update is. It depends on how you do the measurement. What state rho k you get depends on how you do the measurement. So let's look at a concrete example of how to do a particular POVM, and we can determine the state under that concrete example. So we'll look at state update under some indirect measurement. Let's look at state update in the indirect measurement model. So that is, we're going to imagine I start out with some state okay, I'm not going to write everything down, I'm just going to say some things. So here rho is acting in the Hilbert space A, and that's what we're trying to measure, some property of system A. Phi is our ancilla, which you can think of as our measurement apparatus, the initial state of the measurement apparatus, or the ancilla. And then what we want to do is we want to entangle rho and phi with some unitary so that the information we want to gather about rho is encoded in the state of the ancilla. Remember, an example of that we've seen is the Stern-Gerlach measurement, where we entangle the spin degree of freedom with a spatial wave function, measure the spatial position, and then infer the spin degree of freedom. So the general way to describe that is via some interaction unitary that couples our system. And then I'm going to do some measurement on the ancilla. And then based on the outcome of that measurement, now I'll get some output state of the system. So in particular, what we have is given outcome K, we have rho goes to rho K. And remember rho is an element of the linear operators on HA, as is rho K. Using kind of my standard notation for A and B for the system and apparatus. And then what do we want to do? Well, we just apply the projection postulate as stated. We're going to apply the projection postulate, and then we're going to trace out the system we don't care about. So what's the projection postulate? It's this. What we've written already. Now note that this object here, this is a projector. All right, as is this. So identity tensor of projector is another projector. You can check that it satisfies the properties. It squares to itself, and it's, of course, Hermitian, or self-adjoint. But then we also have to renormalize by the probability of outcome k so that rho k has trace 1. And now we're saying this is the projection postulate applied to the total system. But we don't care about the total system. We just care about the system of interest, Hilbert space A. So now we take a partial trace over Hilbert space B. And that's our updated state. But now surely we can have this in a more compact notation. And so we can do that. OK, so now let's simplify this. And our simplification is basically involved just introducing new quantities that simplify the notation. So first of all, for simplicity, I haven't told you what phi is. So let me just choose phi to be equal to 0. OK, so this is just choose. And then we have to evaluate the partial trace, right? So for the partial trace, let's use a basis on B, just indexed by, what's my index here, J? Where J, with J going from 0 all the way up to the dimension of HB minus 1. Okay, why am I subtracting 1 here? Nothing deep there, just a notational nuance. Who understands why I subtracted 1 from that? Because I'm counting from 0. Okay. So if you program in C, you start counting from 0. That's what I'm doing here, so I have to subtract 1 from the dimension. Okay, then we have for the partial trace, we sum over J identity tensor pi k are unitary, rho tensor 0, UAB dagger, identity tensor pi k and j. And I'm summing over j. Remember, j is just a basis for b, so the partial trace takes me to linear operators on another Hilbert space HA. So now these identity things, I'm just keeping them so it's notationally clear. But now J doesn't affect this identity guy, it goes right through it, because remember J is an element of the dual space for HB, which means it's a linear functional in HB, so it's only going to act on operators or kets in HB. So J is going to act on pi k. So we're going to have a sum over J. J pi k UAB 0 rho 0 UAB pi k J. Now the subtlety here is that pi k is an operator on HB. U is an operator on HA tensor HB. So you have to be aware of what's going on here. But if you think about this, if this is confusing, I encourage you to consider a two-level system and a three-level system. Write everything out in terms of matrices, and you'll see what's happening. And then what we can do is we can define Oh, thank you very much. Yeah. Now we're going to define an operator mk, j will be defined as j pi k u a b 0. And of course, this is a linear operator on HA. Okay, then we have rho k, add in a hat, is equal to sum over j mkj rho mkj dagger. And the probability of k now this is going to be neat, okay? So the probability of k, we can write this, and I'll let you check this. We can write this as trace of ek rho, where ek is equal to sum over j mkj dagger m. KJ. So notice this is very similar to a Krauss form. In fact, it's a completely positive map. It's a Krauss form which is not normalized, because that does the normalization for us. Well, if we absorb the square root of probability of K into this, then it is normalized. And this is just of course, I haven't done Krauss operators for you yet, but I think Aggie has touched on it. So remark that this is a special case of a CP map, of a completely positive trace-preserving map, which is also a set of Krauss operators. I should remark that if you look this up in textbooks, often they don't have this sum over j. That's because most textbooks assume that the measurement pi k is rank 1. It's all rank 1 projectors. If pi k consists of rank 1 projectors, then this sum disappears. And that's usually the way people quote it. But here, this is more general. Is that sufficient? Great. So there we have a state update rule, and it depended precisely on the way in which we implemented the POVM. So the POVM is just defined by these EKs, and I could have done this in a very different way. In particular, if I added, just as a final remark, if I let UAB go to V tensor identity UAB, which is basically what that means is after I couple the systems, I apply an additional rotation on system A. Then rho k goes to rho k prime, which is equal to v rho k v dagger. But ek, the probability of k is still equal to the trace of ek rho, and ek is still equal to ek, well, ek prime is equal to ek. So what I'm saying here, and this isn't probably the best notation, if I define the measurement procedure differently, I'm doing the same POVM, but my updated state is different. So this is just an example of this freedom in the description. I'll address now. This freedom in that just specifying the POVM doesn't specify how the state update will work. You have to tell me more about how you did that POVM measure. Okay, great. I think we'll wrap up there. And I think tomorrow I'm away, so Aggie's going to give a lecture. Did you?
Just quantum optics stuff.
Quantum optics stuff. And then Friday I'll be back and we'll talk about, I'll just do generalized transformations, we'll talk about decoherence, and we'll start talking about entanglement finally. Yeah, question in the back?
I was just going to say, so you get, this is just the rule if you remember the measurement, right?
This is all
you, like,
conditional.
See the measurement.
Conditional on outcome k.
Okay, so what would it be if you make the measurement, you know, in this? You know what I mean.
If you ignore the outcome?
You ignore the outcome.
It's exactly the way I described it to you before. I've given you the rho k.
So it's
you just sum over rho k's weighted by the probability of each outcome, and then you get the state without conditioning.
And that's it. Thank you.
So yeah, it just apply the formula I gave you. Is that it? Okay, great. Well, I'll see you Friday.